This is a BBC podcast. You can get all our podcasts and our terms of use at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
And now, the second part of The Foods That Make Billions, our series about the global food industry. Last time we heard the story of bottled water brands which have flourished in developed countries despite water being available free of charge from the tap. This time, it's all the things you never knew about breakfast cereals.
Online, on digital, and on 88 to 91 FM, BBC Radio 2.
So, hi, welcome to the Radio 2 Breakfast Show here, where we have coffee...
When you sit down, bleary-eyed, with a bowl of cereal, you may think you're just grabbing a quick, nutritious breakfast. But you're also contributing to the biggest success story of the modern food industry. Inside the cereal box is one of the most sophisticated combinations of invention, processing and advertising that modern business has ever seen. Understand breakfast cereals and you'll understand the modern food business.
Breakfast cereals in many ways are the archetypal product of modern capitalist food economics.
You start with a whole grain, but then you process it, you strip it of anything that slows down eating.
The kind of foods which have won out have been things like breakfast cereal, which require no cooking, no skills. You just need a bowl, a spoon, a bit of milk and the packet.
The BBC has gained exclusive access to the world's largest food companies to discover the inside story of how big business feeds us. It's the story of how giant food companies transform cheap commodities into hugely profitable brands. And how they persuade us to spend billions by selling us dreams. Cereals are one of the foods that make billions. July 2010. Behind the imposing walls of cereal giants Kellogg's UK headquarters in Manchester, England.
Morning, everyone. Do you want to move a little bit closer, please?
Some of the finest minds in the cereal world have gathered to hear about the future shape of breakfast.
What we're working towards is the 16th of August. This is a critical date for Kellogg's and Choc and Roll.
In 6 weeks, Kellogg's is launching Choc and Roll, its new wheel-shaped cereal. The prize, a slice of the UK children's breakfast market worth over £500 million a year.
Once you get on the shelf, if the product doesn't sell, well, it's going to come off the shelf.
Greg Peterson, Managing Director of Kellogg UK. If new brands don't deliver at the checkout, then the end is swift and brutal, he says. Nothing's left to chance.
This new formula for Choc and Roll, we've been working on this for 2 years. Sometimes you don't get it right the first time, and you learn from your mistake and you come back and try again. We're going to be advertising to mum, both in TV and in press, and we're going to be spending roughly £3 million to do this. And that's a lot of money.
In developed countries like the UK, a staggering 94% of people have a box of cereal in their kitchens. How did this emblematic industry colonise the breakfast table so comprehensively? The answers lie in Battle Creek, a sleepy town in the Corn Belt state of Michigan in the United States. Food historian Bea Wilson takes up the story.
It really goes back to these two extraordinary brothers, W.K. Kellogg and his older brother John Harvey Kellogg. John Harvey Kellogg was the doctor who had set up this sanatorium, which was doing all sorts of weird quack cures involving hydropathy and water and enemas, and he was obsessed with constipation and masturbation and vegetarian diets. And then you have his younger brother, 8 years younger, W.K. Kellogg, who had initially gone into the family business trying to sell brooms, and he was the entrepreneur.
John Harvey Kellogg was a teetotal vegetarian Seventh-day Adventist. When not engaged in giving his patients pint after pint of yoghurt and water enemas, he fed them on tasteless cooked flakes, the precursors of today's cereals. William Keith Kellogg's masterstroke was to add sugar to his brother's plain flakes to make them taste better and easier to sell.
Right from the beginning with breakfast cereal, because of the relationship between these two brothers, there was a double thing going on, an obsession with health from John Harvey and a great desire to make money from WK. And what resulted was Kellogg's cornflakes, which sort of eventually became one of the most successful foods in the world. I think in the year 1911, there were something like 108 different brands of cornflakes all being produced in this one tiny corner of America.
Some say the decision to add sugar to grain was cereal's moment of original sin. It led to unimaginable profits, but it also triggered a debate about food additives that still rages today. And the Battle Creek story set the pattern for cereals in other ways too. For W.K. Kellogg had a visionary commitment to advertising. He gambled a third of his startup capital on one ad in the Ladies' Home Journal, one of the most widely read magazines of the day. Battle Creek's local historian, John Server.
At that time, you could buy a bushel of grain for 75 cents and make $12 worth of cereal from it. And W.K. Kellogg advertising was unbelievable. He put an ad. He asked the women of America, stop buying cornflakes because we can't keep up with the supply. But down at the bottom was a coupon where you could get a supply of corn. Well, reverse psychology, women went out and bought it.
By the mid-1950s, the cereal industry, led by Kellogg's but now joined by many other companies, had grown to an estimated $500 million in value. The route to success was clear. Heavy spending on advertising meant powerful imagery and brand loyalty, and boxes flying off the shelf. And it remains the case today. In our TV age, more money is spent advertising cereals than any other food. And products like cornflakes have been promoted as a lifestyle choice to draw consumers in. In Britain, for example, where people had traditionally enjoyed a cooked breakfast of toast, sausages and eggs, cereals were touted as a modern, aspirational food from the earliest years of TV advertising.
Breakfast cereals have contributed to changing the entire pattern of the meal structure.
Bea Wilson again.
There was a kind of conflict between the traditional English breakfast represented by bacon and eggs and breakfast cereal. In the 1950s, you have maybe 50% of people still eating a cooked breakfast of some form or other, even that if that's only a boiled egg. By the 1970s, that's gone down to about 20%.
Cereals in Britain declared war on the cooked breakfast. Novelist Faye Weldon was on the front line. She was then an advertising copywriter, and one of her clients was Britain's Egg Marketing Board.
I think the battle between the egg and the cereal is a battle between two ways of life. The egg stands for wholesome family and country life. The cereal stands for city life, employment, new ways of thinking, speed, modernity in general. They were trying to persuade everybody that all they needed was a light breakfast, while we were trying to persuade them that what they needed was a good breakfast, and a good breakfast meant eggs.
Faye and her team fought back with one of the most famous ad slogans ever, advising Britons to go to work on an egg. But despite spending almost £1 million a year to advertise, the egg struggled to be cool. Cereals, meanwhile, were slickly branded, even personified by animated characters like Tony the Tiger and Coco the Monkey. And the next wave of the savvy American invasion would completely outflank the traditional British breakfast. A free gift in every box.
The things that we put in the packs, the back panel promotions, was really all part of building a relationship, a more detailed relationship with the consumer.
Jeff Lord, formerly of Kellogg UK. As he recalls from his own childhood, the giveaways became ever more ambitious.
I remember toy submarines. I remember playing with those with my brother and see who could win in terms of going to the bottom and then getting to the top again.
From the end of the Second World War to 1970, UK cereal sales tripled. The egg marketers cracked under cereal's pressure. Eventually, they dropped their go-to-work-on-an-egg campaign. American branded culture had changed a nation's way of life. The food industry offered an alternative to cooking because that's where the big profits lay. It had discovered the ultimate recipe for success, taking grain, a cheap, characterless commodity, and transforming it into premium products. The grain is processed before advertising loads it with meaning.
We take the kernel, we take out the germ, because the germ contains the most oil, and that would go rancid in cornflakes if we didn't take it out. We also take off the skin, because that helps the flavours, the sugar, salt and the malt to penetrate. We then cook it, dry it down, roll it out, and then we toast the finished product.
Breakfast cereals are the archetypal processed food.
Dr. David Kessler, former commissioner of the US Food and Drug Administration.
You start with a whole grain, but then you process it, you strip it of anything that slows down eating. You add reinforcing substances, you add sugar to it, you add other stimuli to it. You make it into a habit. You add the emotional gloss of advertising. You add toys to it. You make it part of the routine. You make it something that is socially acceptable.
A kilo of corn costs about $0.25. On the high street, a kilo of cornflakes can cost almost $5, up to 2,000% more. This process of buying low and selling high is known in the business as adding value. Breakfast cereals are at the heart of this equation. The golden age for food processing was the 1960s. The American dream began the moment you woke up. The cereal business had ballooned in value to almost $1 billion. The food industry seemed to offer convenience, choice and plenty like never before. But then, in 1968, America's CBS network broadcast a game-changing documentary. The film investigated hunger and poverty in America. A young boy spoke of being ashamed that he was penniless. But the film would have much wider ramifications, which would in turn put cereal in the dock. For watching the broadcast was future presidential candidate Senator George McGovern.
The camera focused on this little guy, and they said, "What do you think when you come here every day and you watch the other children eat?" I said, "You know, it's not that little guy who should be ashamed. It's Senator George McGovern."
To assuage his shame, McGovern set up a Senate committee to investigate hunger. But he ended up going further, looking into broader concerns about the American diet. One of the first people to testify before the committee was Robert Choate, a wealthy engineer and self-styled food campaigner. What started out as issues about poverty and malnutrition quickly morphed as he worked with Senator McGovern into issues about the quality of food.
He focused on breakfast cereals primarily because he was disturbed about the manufacturers putting sugar coating. He thought that children were getting too much sugar in the diet. He felt it was a real threat to their nutritional health.
What Robert Choate and Senator McGovern did was they changed the way we began to look at food. It was the opening salvo in what would occupy a lot of attention over the next 4 or 5 decades.
David Kessler again. Choate examined 60 major cereals on the US market and ranked them according to their nutritional value. As B. Wilson explains, he found many of them wanting.
What he found was that out of those 60, 40 of them scored under 100, which effectively made them, as he put it, no better than drinking a shot of whiskey. And this electrified America. It really took them by storm, because up to that point, so many people had thought cereals are really healthy, they're really good for you. And he's suddenly pointing out that actually in an experiment done on rats, they were better off eating the cereal box with some milk than they would have been eating the contents inside.
In fact, nutrients were actually being destroyed in the process of making some cereals. Choate coined the phrase empty calories to describe such unnourishing food. As time went on, the industry faced more widespread criticism.
In the 1970s, there was a kind of backlash against cereals. You have all these kind of people rejecting the whole of the mainstream food culture. You have a sort of counterculture, you have a rise of vegetarianism, and you have a sort of rise of non-branded, non-packaged cereals, muesli, sold through health food shops.
As consumer attitudes shifted, the challenge to process cereals grew. But sugar and grain was a lucrative combination, and the various cereal companies were not about to abandon it. Instead, they sought to change their image, develop new brands, and actually exploit the growing obsession with diet. By the 1980s, for example, one big health fad gave industry giant Kellogg's its perfect opportunity to catch up. Fibre, derived from bran.
Bran and fibre really took off in a huge way over the space of a very few years with the publication of the F-Plan Diet, a hugely successful diet book which advocated eating an extremely high fibre diet.
The issue for Kellogg and for the advertising was that as soon as you mentioned bran, the consumer reaction was, well, that really doesn't taste very nice.
William Eccleshare, former account director for Kellogg UK at the J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency. The genius of Kellogg's, he says, was to take a product associated with bowel movements and introduce it to polite society.
Kellogg recognised that there was an opportunity to pick up on health trends which they'd observed, and they were very, very good at doing their research and understanding what was going on in the broader market. And the brief, very simply, was to take these products, as we put it, out of the medicine cabinet and onto the breakfast table.
To get the public to buy bran, even bran packed with sugar and salt, required a tour de force from the ad men. They didn't disappoint, and sales of the new Kellogg's bran flakes leapt.
I just remember everyone saying, look, just remember, you've got to get across this taste message. You've got to make it very, very clear that these actually taste really good, surprisingly good. You know, advertising isn't a science. It's a bit of art, a bit of magic, a bit of alchemy that all came together to work.
The food corporations had survived the processing debate and adapted by exploiting the growing health market. But already a new threat to the big brands was emerging. By now, it was the age of the supermarket. These enormous retailers were able to use the huge revenues their increased customer base gave them to launch their own products. Own label, as it's known, represented value for money for shoppers, but threatened the supremacy of the mainstream brands. Jeff Lord again.
We thought there were sort of parasites because they were copying our products and riding, if you like, on the back of our advertising. So we were sort of passionate about keeping a gap between our quality and their quality. We felt it was extremely important that we differentiated our products as much as possible from the own label brands.
Own label has had a profound impact on all the big food manufacturers. But unlike other food sectors, where own label has taken nearly half of the market, branded cereals have held on to an 80% share. So why do people prefer them to the cheaper competition? Greg Peterson of Kellogg UK.
They know what they're getting. They know they're getting high-quality food. We have an amazing trust with consumers. So they know what they're getting. They don't always know what they're getting with private label.
And there's another huge advantage that branded cereals have over own labels, he says, because in the established markets of the developed world, consumers grew up with them. They're among the first foods that people engaged with emotionally as children.
I grew up eating Frosties and Cocoa Pops and Fruit Loops. I still eat Frosties and Cocoa Pops and Fruit Loops today. And if my life gets more hectic, it's nice to have some of these things that you can hold on to that tie you back to your childhood and tie you back to when you were younger.
The bonds we make in childhood are the hardest to break. This is the trump card that has allowed the cereal superbrands to see off the own label challenge. But this strategy, for all its advantages, would also prove the industry's most vulnerable point in a struggle with increasingly aggressive regulators. In 2006, for example, the UK authorities made a significant announcement.
Good afternoon. Junk food adverts during any programmes aimed at children are set to be banned. The broadcasting watch.
This would have huge repercussions for the cereal industry. For the first time, many of its well-established brands were officially labelled too sugary to be advertised on children's television. The manufacturers had little choice but to step into line. At Kellogg's, they decided to go back to the laboratory and change the recipes of some of their brands aimed at children, like the chocolatey Cocoa Pops.
There were some new regulations that came in 2007 that said some products can be advertised to children, some products cannot. Well, we, of course, abided by those regulations. Folks are going to make choices around what they choose to eat. And we, as a company, are going to try and make sure we're delivering to consumers what they're asking for. And so on Cocoa Pops, they've asked for something to give them a choice with more fiber and more whole grain in it, and less salt and less sugar. So we've done that. We feel good about it.
As you know, in 2010, one of our business priorities was to make new brands massive.
Summer 2010, and back in Manchester, Kellogg's is pushing on with its big launch. A brand new cereal to cope with the new challenges.
It's called Chalk and Roll. It's high in fiber. It's a source of whole grain. It's got less sugar. It's low in salt, low in saturated fat. And this product meets all of the FSA nutrient profiles.
2 years spent in development, £3 million earmarked for advertising, and Kellogg's has done it again. But perhaps it shouldn't come as any great surprise. As the American food activist Michael Pollan explains, breakfast cereals have always been one of the food industry's most adaptable products.
As culinary and health fads have come and gone, they've been able to re-engineer this product to stay hot. Cereal makers have always stayed one step ahead of the health fads, health authorities, and managed to constantly update their product. So if there's a concern about vitamins, you add some vitamins. If there's a concern about fiber, you add some fiber. If there's a concern about sugar, you can reduce the amount of sugar.
The cereal story is one of constant reinvention, restlessly searching for new ways to add value to grain. The very latest manifestation has left the breakfast bowl altogether, spawning a brand new multi-million pound sector.
We want foods that need as little work as possible. All you have to do is pour them in a bowl and pour milk over it. The interesting thing is, at a certain point, even that begins to seem like a lot of work. So then you move to the next step, which is cereal bars. Cereal bars are for people that don't even have time to pour milk over cereal in a bowl, but want to eat on the run. So you see there's this constant arms race of how can we make this food more processed and more convenient.
Huge empires have been built on the simple idea of endlessly adapting grain, a cheap commodity, and adding value to it. And this processing idea has been replicated across the entire food industry. Each transition promises us, the consumers, convenience, health, dreams, and the food business, money. The cereal industry has come a long way from Battle Creek to its position as undisputed champion of the breakfast table. Cereal has become the blank slate for both our aspirations and our neuroses, and in the process has made billions. Next week, here on the BBC, Healthy Snack, Healthy Profits, how they turned yogurt into a superfood.
The Foods That Make Billions was narrated by Louise Hidalgo. The editor is Jeremy Skeet.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.